It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. If you spend enough time outside right now, you will see some baby animals, a fledgling robin, maybe a row of ducklings, or even, if you're very lucky, a fawn curled up asleep waiting for mom to return. This hour, we're going to talk about wild parenting, and who better to talk about wild parenting with than wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Hi, Jim.
Hi, all right. I'm kind of a wild parent myself.
I suspected as much.
You know, I was thinking about this show. Last week when I was paddling up on the Maquoketa River in northeastern Iowa and Delaware County, and I was watching these nests of cliff swallows. Cliff swallows are these are one of the several species of swallows we have in the state, but they build these mud nests. They're colonial nesters. That means a bunch of them nest together. They build these mud nests. It takes about 1,200 pellets. It's amazing to think of this. 1,200 pellets per nest. And the opening to the nest, and they build them under bridges, and they're called cliff swallows because if they have a cliff, they'll certainly that sticks out far enough, they will build a nest under the ledge of the cliff. But since cliffs are often at a premium in some places, they've taken to adapted well to building them underneath the bridges. Now the opening to this mud nest faces down.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's usually over water. And so that youngster has one chance, basically. They come out of that nest and go, okay, it's fly or get wet and probably get eaten or drowned in the water. And it's a form of parenting that says, you got one chance, kid. That's it. You know? I was thinking, that's tough love. You know, it really is. And it reminded me that there are... In nature, it should teach us that there are a lot of right ways to raise kids. There's not a single way. There are a lot of different ways. And so far as I know, we're the only species that has a Dr. Spock or somebody else to teach us how to parent. Most of what wild parents know is instinctive. It's not learned. It doesn't mean that wild parents don't teach things to their young. They certainly do, but they're not necessarily ways that are familiar to us as a human parents at all.
Well, and that brings up an interesting question because, of course, with most birds, even birds, have a longer period of time to learn the important skill of flying, much longer than swallows.
That's right.
But clearly with swallows, that is not a learned behavior. That is instinctive to be able to spread one's wings and fly.
Right. Yeah. In fact, I was sitting there watching eagles as well. And eagles right now in Iowa, we have them on a number of rivers. And I've had the great privilege of being able to watch some last several weeks, and they're now, the young ones are out, many of them are what we call branchers, which means they're out on the edge of the nest or off the nest onto some adjacent branches, thus branches, and they're using those wings. They're exercising those wings. They spread them out and go flap them, you know, and they don't go anywhere, but they're working on their wings. And I'm wondering what those little swallows do. It's, you know, are they doing that inside
right,
the nest?
Right, what can they do to build their muscles?
Yeah, it's amazing.
That's amazing. And now that's cliff swallows, but barn swallows do the same thing. They don't have the opening at the bottom, but
right.
On the day that you leave the nest, you have to fly.
You got to fly or you hit the ground. And the cat or, you know, something else is there to gobble you up. So it's a really, you know, there are just so many ways to parent. If we look, and we can misinterpret that so often. We look at a parenting style, and in our experience as humans, we look at that and we say, well, gee, was there? They must have abandoned them. And at birth, for example, with cottontail rabbits that we see everywhere in the state, they're placed in a very shallow hole that's maybe 4 to 6 inches deep, covered with fur that's torn from the mother's belly. She tears it up and surrounds the young that are born absolutely blind and hairless, and they're put in this little hole. Then she covers it with leaves or grass. And the nest may be in the middle of a lawn, of a mowed area, not well hidden under some shrubs or anything. And you think, well, why would she do that? Well, part of it is that it actually guards against predation. And you think about, well, what about the lawnmower and kids in the yard? Well, rabbits didn't invent lawnmowers. All they know is that it's in the open and is less likely in the middle of the lawn to be found by predators that are searching the areas of brush nearby for baby rabbits. So the mother comes and visits that site, visits them in the middle of the lawn in the wee hours of the morning or late in the evening. Those dawn and dusk sorts of hours when people and predators aren't around very much. She visits them about once a day for a minute and a half to
wow.
2 minutes, and she nurses them that very brief period, covers the nest back up, and goes away.
And by her absence, she is protecting them.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. By putting them in the middle of the lawn, by only being there briefly, she's actually protecting them. And so we come along and we, our kids or our dogs or something, find the nest. We look around and we say, oh, we don't see the mother. Therefore, we assume that these baby rabbits are abandoned, and we take them out of the nest and rush them to a veterinarian or more often to a wildlife rehabber to try to save them. And when in fact, what we're doing is putting them in terrible, terrible jeopardy.
Right. Well, and having grown up as a wildlife rehabilitator, baby rabbits are actually impossible. To raise successfully.
Right.
And part of that's because of the mother's bacteria that she passes on to them as well.
Yeah, exactly. Through the, not only the bacteria, but the antibodies that she's passing on through the milk, just as human mothers pass antibodies through their milk to the young.
And don't baby rabbits have to eat some of their mother's feces?
Exactly. In order to have the proper flora in their cecum, they have a cecum, which is a little bag sort of towards the end of their intestine that is filled with bacteria, and it's what allows them then to have the right bacteria in that cecum and allows them to digest the herbaceous food, be it leaves or in the wintertime the sticks. They have to have the right bacteria in order to digest it and make use of that. And they can only get that from their mother. So, yeah, it's an amazing thing. So motherhood takes a lot of forms. You know? And we think there's only one way to be a mother, you know, and that's how we do it.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah, we misinterpret what others.
So if you see a baby bunny and you possibly can, leave it alone. The other thing that I think is interesting to us as humans is that so many of these tiny babies are actually independent. And rabbits are the perfect example of that, because if you see a little bunny the size of your fist, if its ears are up straight and its eyes are bright and it's hopping around the lawn, it looks incredibly vulnerable, but it's on its own.
It's on its own. That's right. Once they come out of that nest, they are on their own. Now, the mothers, and I know this because I've been... farther north, we have snowshoe hares, and hares are different than rabbits in that the young are born in just basically a hollow spot in the ground, not a hole. And at birth, they are what we call precocial. They're fully furred, their eyes are open, their ears are open, and they're on their own from day one. Except that their mother is around and they will meet with her again for about 2 minutes a day to nurse, and that's it. But otherwise, they're hopping around on their own with their mother nearby. And so I was live trapping rabbits in traps up there to mark them and release them and doing a study on snowshoe hares. And several times when I would capture during the summertime a young one, they scream. I don't know if you've ever heard rabbits scream. Mm-hmm. You probably have, but they really do scream.
And most of the time, it's the final sound they make if they scream.
Yes,
but
that's right. Yeah, yeah. So when I'm processing them, weighing them, and measuring them and everything, they were screaming. and the mother came right down the trail. it's amazing. So they are around, even though you don't see them. Another example is our deer fawns, as we know, and you mentioned this in your introduction, that they're sort of a tawny brown, and they have these white spots on them. And we think, gee, what are the white spots for? And that's so that they can lay beneath shrubs and or tall grass and not be spotted. They are dappled just like the sunlight then that peaks between the leaves. So they're actually camouflaged. The dappling on them is like the dappling on the forest floor. And so when we come upon it, we look at and we accidentally, you know, uncover them as we're walking through tall grass or through the shrubs in the woods, and we see this fawn. And we look around and we say, well, there's no mother. She must have abandoned them. You know? And the same scenario repeats itself. We save the fawn by taking it to a wildlife rehabber, when in fact it would have been much safer and much more likely to reach adulthood if it had been left alone in the woods. Motherhood takes many forms. Parenthood takes many, many forms.
Well, and with mother deer, although they are absent most of the time, they nurse the baby, then they go off on their own and they come back and nurse the baby. They come back a lot more often than rabbits.
Right.
But
right.
They'll also, I mean, the long-term relationship between the doe and her fawn or fawns gets to be more interactive as they grow, right?
Right, right. And in fact, they'll often stay with her for a very long period of time. Unlike those young swallows, once they're out of the nest, they're on their own, and they have to find their own meals. That seems to be, incidentally, an interesting, at least partially learned behavior. They learn to fly on their own or not. And once they're in the air, they fly around with their mothers, and they seem to have to learn how to capture insects in the air. And that it reminds me of young pheasants or young quail that are also precocial. They're born fully feathered, although small, and their eyes are open. And within 24 hours of hatching out of that egg, just like baby chicks, they are out with their mother. So they're not alone. She is with them. But she teaches them how to eat. They imitate her. As she scratches on the ground, and these little chicks will scratch, and then she'll peck down with her beak, and they'll imitate that. So the act of imitation seems to be genetic, but what they do by imitating that is they'll pick up grit, they'll pick up seeds, they'll pick up insects that they need to grow. And she will, I don't know if you've ever watched, I'm sure you have watched a hen teach her chicks this trick, but pheasants and quail and turkeys do the same thing. They're out with their mother, and she's sort of teaching them. But and she, if you listen to them, they'll talk at the same time. They kind of, you know, as they go along. So it's an amazing way of parenting,
and
totally,
you know,
different than what we do.
We're going to have to take a break here in a moment, but Stephanie's on the line in Fairfax, which I think with the most commonly asked question on this subject. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
What's your question?
I just have a question about over the weekend there was an injured baby bunny, and it was laying on the ground, and my son and I kind of went over and just kind of stroked it with our finger and kind of just said a little prayer over it. And a young man came up and said, don't touch that bunny because now the mom won't come back. And so my son and I, of course, were mortified that we caused this imminent demise of this poor little baby. And so I was just curious, is that really true? Because I Googled it, and there's so many conflicting things. Is it true that you can't touch it, or what should you do?
No, it was fine that you touched it. At that stage, by the time they're out on their own, they are indeed on their own. The mother isn't coming back anyway. And so you didn't hurt anything. But even in the nest, by handling them, the smell of her fur is still on them. So Don't worry about it. It wasn't your fault at all.
Absolutely. They will not reject their babies based on the scent of a human. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We're talking about wild parenting today. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. And we're talking about nature and nurture today. We're talking about wild parents. And, of course, the biggest take-home message so far, Jim, is if you see a wild animal baby, it's probably not in trouble, and you shouldn't interfere.
Yeah, don't interfere.
But if you touch it, the mother will still take care of it.
That's right. That's right. She'll still be. You know, I was watching wood ducks. I've seen lots of wood ducks this spring, and they're another one that you just kind of go, oh my gosh, those poor babies. You know, because wood ducks are a duck that nests in cavities, in holes, in old hollow trees, or in wood duck houses that people put up. But originally, of course, before the invention of wood duck houses, they nested in holes and still nest in holes in trees. Well, the wood ducks have a very tough first 24 hours, the little ones do. They are also precocial, that is, they're born covered with down and tiny wing feathers, their eyes are open. And once they're hatched, mom leaves the nest, and which is often 20, 30, even 40 feet up in a tree someplace. and then she stands below on the ground calling to the young up in the nest. And her call means, get down here on the double right now. and the little ones do so. They climb up the sides of the cavity inside using little nails on their feet, and they go out the hole and tumble, sometimes end over end, flapping their wings like crazy, trying to get to the ground, trying to fly, doesn't work, and they land on the ground below. They scramble up, they're unhurt. And then they walk with their mother to the nearest water, and that nearest water might be up to a mile away.
Wow.
So this is
how life begins.
Yeah, that's right. It's pretty amazing. So lots of different kinds.
Next time your kid complains because they have to walk from the car to the grocery store.
There you go. There you go. Or to school, heaven's
right.
sake.
Oh.
Oh, my God. You can point that out to them and say, oh, you think you've got it tough.
So, of course, most ducks and geese, their offspring are more fortunate because the nests are on the ground.
On the ground,
that's
right.
All they have to do is just follow mama or papa.
That's right.
Start moving.
Or both sometimes, but
right.
not very often. It's often just mom. In fact, in a lot of ducks, in the mallards that we see often, the males, as soon as the hen is on the nest, the males kind of lose interest, you know, and they go off in these sort of bachelor groups. Once the female is sitting on the eggs, they go off in these bachelor groups and play cards, and you know, I don't know. They go. You see them hanging around sandbars. Sorry.
How long have you been waiting to write?
Yeah, I had to set that one up.
Right.
You
know? So one of the things that I found so interesting with waterfowl, though, are the fact that you so often see them in groups. You'll see so many goslings together with, you know, a few mama Canada geese, and then the papa Canada geese are looking around being extra vigilant off in the distance. But there will be 20 or so goslings. So is there a communal parenting going on here, or do they all divide up into their family units?
Well, in cities is where you primarily find these very large groups. In the wild, groups of more than 3 to 5 young are unusual because the eggs get preyed on by raccoons or foxes or skunks, the young get to serve as meals for other things. So they're usually much smaller groups. But in the cities, where it's safer for a lot of times, believe it or not, you'll see these huge groups of 10 or 12 goslings with a mother goose. However, if another goose nests nearby, and they often do in the city, not so much out in the wild, but within cities, they often will have several nests within a park. And if the young are about the same age, they seem to combine almost. And you'll see these groups of 20, 25 young goslings behind four adult geese, sometimes even five. And this is where a helper sometimes comes in. A helper is usually a female from the previous year. So this is like a daughter, an older daughter, if you will, that is helping mom for the first year. She may be non-breeding for whatever reason for that first year, and she often helps. And we'll see that occasionally in a number of species.
Very interesting. Yeah. We have a tweet here, and you're welcome to join our conversation, by the way. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And here's a question. Well, it's a comment, but the tweeter says, I've never seen a baby squirrel. Jim, why might that be?
Well, you haven't looked close enough.
Right.
That's right. They're out there.
But you don't see little tiny baby squirrels.
Not little tiny ones. They are in the nest, which is usually in a hollow tree, but may occasionally be in those leaf nests you see if there aren't enough hollow trees around. But usually it's in a hollow tree. And until they are, they're not precocial. They're born blind, hairless, et cetera, in the nest. And the mother goes back and has to nurse them on a regular basis. And once they are big enough to run around, they're a little smaller than the fully adult squirrels. But if you look, you begin to watch them. They are slightly smaller. But once they come out of the nest, they're pretty much on their own as well.
Well, and you should look for them.
Right.
Because I find squirrels of that age to be the most fun to watch. These little teenage squirrels are crazy.
Yeah, just like our teenagers, you know. That's right. They're nutty. They're trying all kinds of stuff, trying to figure out what the boundaries are. They'll try and jump from branch to branch.
Well, and they're kind of like Spider-Man. I mean, they're so gifted at jumping, and they will try impossible leaps.
Yeah, it's great fun. It's great fun to watch. So, yeah. Now, let's go to a different kind of motherhood.
Okay.
In bees, okay? So this is honeybees. And a colony is made up of about 50,000 or so sisters. They're all offspring of a single mom. She was impregnated by dozens of males on her maiden flight. She's a little promiscuous there. The queen, will lay the eggs, but all her daughters, once the eggs are laid, they're in charge. They do all the work. They clean the cells, they tend and feed the larva, they feed the queen, they're heating and air conditioning specialists for the hive. They defend the hive with their lives if they have to. They produce wax, and they're construction engineers because they build those cells then from that. They fly up to a mile or so away from the hive towards the end of their life in a given direction in search of nectar or pollen, and then they turn that nectar into honey with just the right amount, not too much, too little, of moisture, and then communicate where that is with other bees by dancing. So they're also dancers. They do all these jobs, pointing out where the nectar or pollen is to their other sisters. And they do that in a summertime over the course of about 3 to 3.5 or 4 weeks is about the length of the worker's life. And they're all sisters. So in the course of the summer, they'll do that just in a matter of 3 weeks. They're also the undertakers for the hive. They pull out dead bees. And you thought you had it bad as a kid when you had to feed the dog or take out the garbage,
right.
You know. So sisterhood is very, very powerful in a hive of bees. It's pretty amazing.
That's so interesting. And you know, we've talked about how some of the skills that baby animals have to master to be able to survive are instinctive. Some they are copying
right.
a mother or a parent. with bees, everything's got to be instinctive, right?
It's totally instinctive. Yeah, exactly. There is no learning curve. Gee, you didn't clean that hive well enough. Go back and do it again. No, they know that from the day they are born. It's pretty amazing.
That is really remarkable.
Yeah, in fact, I was thinking about this as a parent, you know, as a young parent, I thought, gee, it's got to be all nurture. It's how we raise them and, you know, they become what they are. And as a grandparent now, I look at my kids and my grandkids and think, gee, I think an awful lot of it is genetic. I'm not taking responsibility. It must be genetic.
Oh,
how about as a parent? Do you feel the same way that you have less impact than you thought maybe you would?
Oh, I probably. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. You know, I took credit for how well the first one ate, and then I had a picky eater. And I thought, wait, that can't be me.
Exactly.
You know, one of the things we've talked about so many different varieties of parents, and they spend such a differing amount of time with their young. Let's talk about that difference, because, you know, we were talking about the swallows who come out of the nest and they start flying, they learn to eat, and then they're on their own. And
they're
the baby bunnies
own.
Who grow up and then they're on their own. Right. You mentioned earlier that a mother deer will stay with her fawn, or a fawn mm-hmm. will stay with her, sometimes for at least a year.
Oh, yeah.
And beavers.
Certainly into the fall and
right?
early winter, yeah.
With beavers, I know that sometimes the young will stick around for 2 years and help raise the next year's
right.
young.
Exactly.
Of the animals that we have living in Iowa, is that one of the longest term relationships?
That is pretty long. Let me tell you about one that's a little shorter than that. Snakes. Snakes have no parents to model themselves after. In egg layers, which most of our snakes are. Now, garter snakes are ovoviviparous, meaning that they have egg layers, but they retain the eggs inside their body, so it looks like they're live born. They hatch in the mother and they crawl out. But most of our snakes are egg layers, and the eggs are deposited, for example, in some damp rotten log in a hill of rock or sand or underneath a board or, you know, some place like that, and they hatch. They are a fraction of the size of their mother. They might look like the size of an earthworm. And then they begin to try to find something to eat. Because they're on their own, there's no help, there's no training. The mother laid the eggs and left. So they've lived off for a while. They can live off the nutrients that they've obtained from the yolk that was in that egg. But basically, they're on their own. And that's pretty amazing. It's certainly tough love to be a snake, to get out there. And you don't even have a mother around to know what you look like. Think about the ugly duckling, you know, let alone know how to find food or what food to find. It's all trial and error. And one of the reasons that garter snakes, for example, have so many young is exactly that. That many of them, quite honestly, don't make it. Rabbits are the same way. A lot of those young don't make the transition to being on their own. So it's very, very tough for young snakes.
We have a number of calls I want to make sure we get to here, a number of people who have questions. And first we'll go to Mike in Riverside. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
We have a small pond, and for the last 3 years, we've had a floating platform on it mm-hmm. with a tire and some straw. And this year, for the first time, we had geese actually nest there
right.
and hatch. But the day that they hatched, or day after they hatched, the mother took them for a walk, and they never came back.
Right. Yeah, she'll go to another pond that she feels is safer for some reason. And even though you've done all the provision you can, you know, it's they just choose otherwise. That's mothers for you. You know, sometimes they decide what's safe.
We just use our best judgment, Jim. Lay off mothers.
Well, all right.
We watched her sit on that nest for a month.
Sure.
And then, you know, we were hoping to watch the young ones grow up, but...
Yeah.
There are several other ponds in our area, and that's what our neighbor told us, was that they don't stay on the pond that they hatch on. They always seem to go to a different one.
Now, they may come back, and that's what's interesting. They'll shift around to different ponds, and, you know, if she's in a pond that's got a big snapper, for example, and it takes one or two of her young, she's going to go, I'm getting out of here, and she'll move them to another pond or to a river, or, you know, she's just trying to do the best job she can, like most mothers, and Charity, and and is trying to keep them as safe as she possibly can.
Mike, thank you so much for your call. This one's from Jeff. He says, I know you talked about this. We have a bunny nest in our yard. Is there any truth? And I think this bears repeating. So right, is there any truth to the fact that if you touch or handle a baby rabbit and put it back in the nest, the mother will not feed it or kill it?
No, there's no truth to that at all. It's an old tale that I don't know how it got started, but maybe
probably
it was a way
by
to...
human mothers who didn't want their children picking up wild
picking
animal
up baby
babies.
Rabbit. I think you're probably right. Yeah.
If you do that, it'll be the death of you. You know?
Exactly, and of it, and it's all your fault.
That's right.
So no, I mean, and of course, to anthropomorphize, this is they are just as likely to give up on their baby because it smells like you as you would be to give up on your baby because it smells like them.
That's right. That's exactly right. So
All right, Ellen is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I have a couple of them, if I'm allowed that many, but my first one has to do with baby cardinals.
Okay.
We have cardinals in our arborvita, and I have never in all these years seen a baby cardinal. I've seen baby robins, mm-hmm. but no baby cardinals. So what's the deal?
Well, they're there, unless they haven't been successful at raising them up. But again, they are almost adult size, although they're sort of scruffy. Their feathers are not fully developed when they come out of the nest, but they're beginning to be. In fact, we've got cardinals right now, mothers, and you can watch them. If you have bird feeders around, you can tell the difference. Even though they may look exactly like their mother when they're young. And this happens with bunches of the sparrows and chickadees and cardinals and robins. Robins you can tell because they have little speckles on their breasts, but cardinals you can't necessarily, except watch their behavior. They will stand beside mom as mom gets food out of the feeder, and they'll cheep at her and shiver. They take their feathers and they sort of shiver on the side, going, oh, feed me, please, one more meal. And she will, sure enough, will feed them. So you'll be able to tell the difference that way by behavior. And they will do that as long as they can, as long as she puts up with it. And this can last in some birds. Well into the fall. I'm thinking now particularly of great horned owls, which are already fledging, and barred owls, which are soon to fledge to leave the nest. They will pester their parents. You'll hear their food calls well into the fall of the year. You know, Mom! Dad! Food! And once you learn to recognize that sort of wah! That's what it is. It's young owls, and so lots of birds will pester their parents to feed them, sort of like kids coming home from college.
Living in the basement. That's right.
Well, and
Ellen, we'll let you ask a second question here in a second, but before we get to that, Jim, I want to talk about songbirds for a second, because she brought up cardinals.
Mm.
And a lot of us do see the fledglings when they get out of the nest and they're on the ground. And they're down there on the ground. They're incredibly vulnerable. The parents are flying around. Mm. They're angry.
Yeah.
they don't want to see you. They don't want to see your dogs. Right. They don't want to see any cats or anything like that. How long does it take a fledgling to learn to fly once they hit the ground?
Once they hit the ground, if they don't have wing feathers, primary feathers, chances are they've either fallen out of the nest or they've been pushed. It happens, not necessarily brothers and sisters, but sometimes interlopers in the nest, cowbirds and other things, will push them out of the nest. You can take them, and if you can reach the nest, put them back in there. But if their wing feathers are fully developed, leave them alone. They're fine. They'll pick it up pretty quickly. They have to exercise those wings. and it might take a day or two before they can actually fly. If they haven't been outside the nest before on a branch exercising their wings, it does take them, 24 to sometimes 48 hours, depends on the species. And actually, the parents will continue to feed them, continue to protect them in an amazing way, actually, during that time. So you're better off leaving them alone.
All right. And we have this email with the same moral to the story. This is from Stephanie in Cedar Rapids. I've not seen true baby squirrels, but we did find three very small juvenile squirrels running around in front of our house while we moved into it. We made the mistake of letting them play with us, which meant climbing me. And unfortunately, they seemed to think this meant they were now my family and could just come right into the house. After a lot of creative problem solving, we managed to keep them out of the house, but they did go into the backyard and felt completely safe, which they weren't. Suffice it to say, my dog was not as kind to them as I was, and my curiosity doomed these poor little creatures to a less than happy fate with my overenthusiastic dog.
Right.
My warning to others is watch, but don't, but keep your distance.
Great advice. Right.
and that is the sad thing, is that, you know, out of love or out of curiosity, so many people do want to get close. And it often does mean the death of the animal that you are so interested in.
That's right. And keep in mind, too, that one of the reasons, as I mentioned earlier, so many critters have so many young, just as human species did in this country a century ago, had 10, 12 kids, was quite honestly so that a few would survive.
Right.
And the same is true in wildlife. We don't like to think of it that way. So death is part of it. And it's pretty amazing when you think about the varieties of parenting. It's very dangerous to anthropomorphize, as you pointed out, but we want to do that sometimes, and we think, oh, we'll know better by trying to save them, but we really don't.
So the best of intentions can
best
often
right.
lead to a problem. Well, Jim, thank you so much. And it sounds like we can see a whole lot of interesting behavior this time of year if we just keep our eyes open.
Yeah, it's just great. It's really fun to watch. Lots of critters out there now because of they're getting out of the nests, getting out of their holes, whatever. And watch them while you can, and watch from a distance, as our emailer just said.
I saw baby wild turkeys for the first time in my life yesterday.
Ah, that's great.
So
that's
that
great.
Was wonderful. Jim Pease, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is based in Ames. He's also an environmental interpretive wildlife consultant as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.